Okay.
He called the committee to order, and I think is Representative Morrow. We'll start with your bill.
Take an answer.
Yeah, we're talking about coming. Okay, great. Okay, this is part of what we're doing is that memorandum that I sent out yesterday about the proposed a recommendation of our priorities for capital finance, investment finance division. And this is the only part that's kind of formal for this appeal. The other parts are not fleshed out recommendations. So, Representative Mark.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Madam Chair, members, I'm here about House File 796, the Minnesota First Bond Bill. Madam Chair, members, this bill is designed to enable the Commissioner of Finance to create the Minnesota First Bond Program. This will allow private investors to invest directly in Minnesota projects. The idea here is to have smaller denomination sales. You've seen the bill. It's a $1,000 denomination and above. We received this idea from construction companies, from contractors and the like, who wanted to be able to invest in Minnesota deal bond type of projects. Kathy Cardell from Management Budget could not be here today. She apologizes to describe the bill. She is ill. But I can tell you that from her perspective in the last committee, she strongly supported the bill, thought this was a good idea. This is another tool they could have. She called some brokers and dealers to get their input on this program. They supported the program. They thought this is another option that investors should be able to have. In fact, the day that she testified, she had gotten a call from a potential investor who asked, does Minnesota have this type of program as other states do? And she said, no, I'm sorry, we don't. There was a fiscal note with this bill. The fiscal note was primarily directed toward the zero coupon option. The zero coupon option, members, doesn't work particularly well right now because the fees associated with it would outpace the return on the investment. So that's why we change it from a zero coupon only option, giving the Commissioner of Finance greater latitude on what type of bonds to issue. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer questions.
So, in a sense, this fiscal impact that's listed is would only occur if they decided to sell the zero coupon bonds, and the likelihood is that they wouldn't.
Madam Chair, members, there would still be some fiscal cost, but much of it goes away. The fiscal cost that would remain would be for marketing. For example, Ms. Cardell, or Commissioner Cardell, would explain that selling these bonds on the web would be one thing that other states do that we would want to look at doing. But she thought that the marketing and other costs, Madam Chair, would run into $10,000 to $20,000 range per bond offering.
Okay. This reminds me of when I was a child and all the war bond signs that we used to, so we can reconstitute those old.
Remember, that is actually where I got the idea, was from the war bond idea together with the constituents down in the Mankato area.
When I was in graduate school, actually, which is a long time ago, but well after the war, one of the outstanding pizza places in New Haven, which, Connecticut, which is the pizza capital of the world in terms of the best available pizza anywhere, had still had their old posters up, which was with the Buy Liberty and then the Buy Bonds, and then it also had this burning ships with it said underneath, somebody talked. I always remembered those being around when I was a little kid and really worrying about what I was going to say and have those ships blow up. But anyway, are there any questions about this bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, does the Department of Finance/MMB, are they on board with this? Do they have any problems with this?
Madam Chair, members, as I mentioned earlier, Assistant Commissioner Kathy Cardell, who couldn't be here today because she was ill, strongly supported the bill. In the previous hearing, we met in my office. She was very excited. She had been wanting to do something like this in the past. There had been some opposition within the department, but she believes now that the department would be on board and would welcome this tool.
And all these things have a long way to go from here.
A follow-up, Madam Chair, sort of. Do other states have similar programs or programs just like this?
Madam Chair, members, there are other states that have these programs. I apologize. Since the Commission Credit Office has the exact list of those states, if you did testify, other states do this, and that's how she's able to estimate, for example, what the marketing cost would be by talking to her counterparts in other states.
Okay.
And, Madam Chair, I assume there's no motion that needs to be made at this point.
Oh, we might as well, since it's a bill and it's before us. we send these things on by either memo or bill, but if we can, we'll do both. So, Representative Stringham moves that the bill be recommended to pass and go on to capital investment.
I make that motion.
Oh, everything goes to finance.
Yeah, I meant
okay.
Finance, sorry.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you, members.
And we'll also send it in our mail. Now, the memo that was before you yesterday that I would like to send on, if there's no objection, I would like to send that on to capital investment. Representative Pepin gave me her opinions on it, and one of the things she's a little concerned about is the funding for a Tier 3 data center. And my intention for how that would work, if I want to alleviate people, is that it's just to kind of, Representative Downey, and I don't know if you've sent, I don't know if you've introduced that in bill form, or if you've circulated to all the committees, to the committee members. Well, we should. Representative Downing has presented some set of alternatives, which you may not want. Anyway, you can say. Yeah, sure, you want it. Well, I just want to say what it is. You can explain what it is. I want to say what it is in relation to this. My idea is to put the idea of building construction and bonding out in front of the capital one, because that is the only way we can use general obligation bonds to support building. To support information processing acquisition. And so Representative Downey has this bill which he'll explain, which means that we look at everything. The nice thing about saying that you're going to look at bonding, and of course we have no idea where this goes from here. So, you know, whether it gets into a bonding bill, whether the governor supports it or not. The nice thing is that that's a really gradual process, and my thought is, My thought is that this would be passed in the bonding bill, but the bonds would not be let at all until we went through Representative Downey's process, and there's a very long time between passing a bill that has says you can do some bonding and doing it. So even if we were going at full speed, you'd have time to invoke Representative Downey's process. So why don't you talk about your process?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So what I actually have is just a draft bill. It hasn't been jacketed at all, and the intention was to get some discussion started with OET, but it was driving toward some of the comments that I made at the end of the committee yesterday, that we could, in fact, engage in a procurement process that would allow us to compare these alternate solution models. And so the bill would actually grant the appropriation, but prescribe, and this is where I wanted to be careful about how prescriptive to be anti-OET hands in ways we don't want to, maybe, but prescribe them to go through such said procurement process.
And we might still do that if we do the appropriation route, but what I'm interested in the bonding route is it's the one way to get to use general obligation funds to avoid the have us not do the appropriation, which is clearly going to be problematical this year. So.
Correct. And if I might, Madam Chair, if we did ask OET to go through that process, that's a fairly lengthy process, so they probably wouldn't be ready to expend funds for a period of time anyway in terms of that between the contract and being started. So necessarily an incompatible thing here.
So if there is no objections, I intend to send this memo that I distributed to Representative Housman.
One quick question, Madam Chair. Do you have any general amounts in mind for capital building restoration or the tier 3?
The amount that's been kicked around is $3 million or $2 million. They're all, you know, as I said, I announced at one point to the committee, the last time we got to do this and sent it to the capital event, we worked incredibly hard. We had a really detailed
prioritization, and we had a really detailed reason for everything, and they totally ignored us. So this time I decided we start from this route instead. And if we're totally ignored again, at least we want to put all that time into it. That's probably things I shouldn't say on the tape, but it's all right. Might as well. Okay, so if there's no objection, I will forward this on with the understanding that there's going to be a lot of discussions about the amounts and so forth. Okay, great. Okay, should be Representative Winkler. Oh, okay. Representative Virginia, your bill has to go to a bunch of places, so we'll take you next.
Well, thank you.
This goes back to finance also.
Yes, please.
So, well, I think we just have to send it to finance and they do it.
Madam Chair, I move that House File 1086 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Okay, Representative Winkler so moves. Representative Regina.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. When we passed the proposed constitutional amendment last year, we did not write any governance provisions for the fund. It was one exception, and I'll tell you about that. But if you would look, for example, on page 2 of the bill that I'm proposing, you'll see the Parks and Trails Fund, and there's two sentences. And the two sentences say the money earned and where it goes. So that's all we did, with the exception of, in a later bill, adopting an advisory committee to the legislature.
Representative Virginia Steck and members of the committee should have done this at the start. The parts that are relevant to us are really just sections 1 and section 2. Although, you can say anything else you want to that.
Well, I will just tell you that what this, and that's what I'm doing, is just giving you a little background. This is some of the governance provisions, and there are, actually, I think there may be three things to look at, but the first one is to have accountability to citizens. And one of the ways we are doing that is to make sure in this bill that every proposal has a measured outcome when a proposal is made. And that measured outcome then will go up on a website so citizens can see what is being proposed to be bought on their behalf. And then when those outcomes are measured, when the project is completed, then that project will also go up on, that measured outcome will also go up on this website. I would envision that there would be two other things on the website, and that would be some of two other things. One, so citizens could know where to go to apply for money. This wouldn't do any of that applying or allocating, but it would give citizens information. And it would provide linkages to things like our statewide conservation plan, so citizens would have some resources. And basically, that is all that provision does. It is letting citizens know how their money is being spent. The second piece is on page 2, and that's restoration audit. We have the audit now do two kinds of audits. One is a financial audit. The second kind is a program audit. However, so much of the money that should be spent or will be spent with this new constitutional money will be to do restorations, because that's what the Constitution provides for. This allows the legislative auditor to do restoration audits, actually have folks go in the field and say, did the citizens of Minnesota get what they paid for? And those are the two sections you mentioned. There was one other section I thought you might be interested in.
Okay.
And that would be on page 5, I believe. Yeah. And that is that instead of having the Department of Natural Resources staff the council, it would be the Legislative Coordinating Commission. And so those are the three pieces of this that I thought maybe you'd be interested in looking at.
Madam Chair, Representative Wagini, is just to be clear, so the cost of establishing this comes out of the fund?
Yes.
And so that, how does, that then, is that part of the target for this committee through for the legislative budget, or how does that work?
This will end up in Representative Murphy's committee, and so the monies will be carried in that committee, as far as I understand. Because we'll be sending money out of each of the funds proportionately to set up the website, and that's where this bill will end up.
If you notice in the existing language that the Department of Natural Resources was being refunded from the fund too. In there. So, you know, as I said, so many places have to deal with this that I think at this point it's not useful for us to look at what the cost of this will be for our committee. We'll have to go into this full target process. Is there anyone from the Legislative Auditor's Office here? Okay. Have they made any comments on the restoration orders? Or
they say we can do the job.
Oh, okay. Okay. And again, those of you who are on finance will see this bill, and on other committees will see this bill quickly with, again, it has a long path to go. So, Representative Dennis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a few questions about the consistency of this bill with the original intent. I'm guessing that there is a cost of compliance for the project along with the state costs, and in fact, it's just kind of vague in my mind, but do we not have like a 1% threshold for administration and oversight? And how confident are we that we're going to stay within that? And I know as a project manager on large-scale projects, managing and tracking data like this can sometimes be easily 10 to 15% of a project. So I'm curious how we're perhaps staying within that 1% threshold.
If I could, I think the administrative expense, the 1% that we're talking about, was the 1% for the Heritage Council only. So if you are talking about I am not on that council and I haven't been through their deliberations, but I think if there is work to be done on a project, you're hiring somebody to go out and plant a field and plant a tree, that is not included within the 1%.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
Madam Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 1086 be recommended to pass and move for the Committee on Finance.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you, members. If you all have any questions later, I'd be glad to talk to you. Thank you.
I will do Representative Winkler's bill. And this is a bill that was actually has a strange pursuit. It had strange path, I should say. It was passed through Government Operations Committee, went to the floor of the House and the Senate, was then referred back to the Hinton, the question of the effect that this had on state investment processes meant it was referred back to the Pensions Committee, who then looked at it and decided that it wasn't their job to do anything really except look at it, but passed it out with a positive motion to go back to the floor and then get sent to the Finance Committee. Now I can start passing these around. I can pass these are. These have a relationship to Representative Winkler's bill, although it's not considered to be a bribe in favor of doing it. When the bill first appeared, before the Pension Commission, it was more appropriate because it was the week of the Jewish holiday of Purim. Now, Purim is an important holiday, particularly important for little Jewish girls because it was only one of the few where the heroine was a woman. This is the Feast of Esther. And what happens is that Esther then stood fast against the Persians, which is now modern Iran. In fact, Esther's tomb is in the city of Hamadan, which is in the country of Iran. And Esther went to Esther ended up with the king Ahasuerus, and she was able to tell him about the plot that the evil Haman, who was his advisor, had to destroy the Jews. Of course, now Iran is possibly, with the achievement of nuclear weapons, much broader target than just the Jews. And so, so Haman was hung instead. So he was destroyed. And so then these pastries are called Hamantaschen, which either means Haman's hats or Haman's pockets, depending on whether you use a Hebrew or a Yiddish or a German translation. And it's a big celebration, and what these are. I'm sorry, these are inferior. The one in the week before, we had homemade ones, mainly from Judy Cook, who's a superb cook, and then we had ones brought from Cecil's Delicatessens, which are a little better than these Costco ones. This was all. Anyway, anyone is welcome to have them, and we'll have Representative Winkler tell us about the modern problems with the modern Persian.
Madam Chair, I don't really know how to proceed. let me first move the House File 111 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Finance Committee.
Okay.
And I have an amendment, the A3 amendment, that I would also like to move be adopted.
Okay, you want to explain the A3
sure.
amendment?
Madam Chair, members, the A3 amendment is the substance of the sense of the Pension Commission on what changes should be made to this bill. As the Chair noted, the bill is actually sitting in the General Register until Monday. The Pension Commission heard the bill on an informational basis because they didn't have jurisdiction, but they did take a series of informal votes on the sense of the Pension Commission. This was parliamentary procedure on the fly to give us advice on what they wanted to see done to the bill. And so the A3 amendment is the three things that they want to see done. In lines 1.2 through, I think, 1.7, well, there are three pieces to this, and it's not easy to go through it line by line. Basically, the Pension Commission urged that the scope of investment to be divested of be expanded from equity holdings to debt. They wanted some cleanup in how reporting was done on these changes, which is also in here. And third, they wanted, there's a provision in the bill that says the State Board of Investment doesn't have to divest if they determine that doing so would not be in their fiduciary, meet their fiduciary obligations. And in that instance, the Pension Commission wanted the State Board of Investment to pursue shareholder resolutions as an alternative. So those are the three pieces that they urged, and that's the amendment, the A3 amendment.
Okay. Any questions about the A3 amendment? We are going to bring Mr. Bicker up, who's sitting looking anxious.
Madam Chair.
Rebecca.
Again, I'm sorry I had a distraction here. What is the substantial change that your amendment makes to the original bill? What changed in the essence of it? I apologize.
Oh, sure, Madam Chair.
Let me say, the most substantial one as a member of the Pension Commission was that the report goes to the executive director of the commission instead of the chair and vice chair. We decided that was a much better place to have it. So, anyway, Representative Winkle.
Madam Chair, Representative Giffmeyer. Yes, that's the reporting piece. Just essentially some technical changes to make reporting on these actions clear. The second piece is that in the event the Pension Commission, I'm sorry, the State Board of Investment determines that divestment from these holdings would be not in the fiduciary interest of the, or meet their fiduciary obligations, that they could then instead pursue a shareholder resolution. And then the final piece was to broaden the subjected investments from just equities to debt holdings as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Those are the three things they took a vote on and sent us on the
list.
Thank you.
Without objection. Okay. Any other questions on the amendment? Okay. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment passed. Okay, Mr. Bicker.
Can I do one minute on the bill for those who haven't had the pleasure? Thank you. Many of you may know that Iran is one of four countries that is on the U.S. Government's list of state sponsors of terrorism. They've been there since the 1980s. Currently, under U.S. law, U.S. companies are not allowed to engage in business with Iran in their energy sector. It may be broader, actually, but particularly their energy sector. While as a member of the Senate, now President Obama sponsored a bill to enable states to divest themselves of from companies that do, foreign companies that do business in Iran. And since that time, the President has reaffirmed this approach, has issued sanctions against companies doing business with Iran. And so this bill basically requires the State Board of Investment to divest of holdings in companies, foreign companies that do business in Iran's energy sector. And the bill that therefore is similar to what we did with the Sudan in 2008, I believe, and is targeted and effective. There are reports already that one of the companies, Total, the French energy company, has backed away from certain joint ventures in Iran's oil fields and gas fields because of sanctions. So there's evidence that this works. It's the policy of the administration, and it is something that Minnesota can do along with, I think, nine states that have passed this, or I can't remember, it's five or nine that have passed it, and over 20 are considering this. And much bigger states than Minnesota have passed this legislation, including Florida and Arizona. So we are following in the footsteps of states that made a much bigger impact, but at least are consistent with the growing movement of American states who are trying to get in line behind the federal government in ensuring that we are not putting our money into securities that are helping not just a terrorist state, but a state that's actively pursuing nuclear terrorism.
I'm particularly impressed by your set of co-authors, which includes Kelleher and Seifert. I think I've never achieved that on any bill I've tried.
Madam Chair, it's either a sign it's a really good idea or a really bad idea.
Okay. Any questions of Jennifer, Representative Klein?
I will reiterate once again the position, having served on the State Board of Investment 8 years and having drilled into us the sense of the fiduciary responsibility. And I look at this and say, well, Iran's pretty obvious and go through that, and this is not about the foreign policy situation. It's coming from the fiduciary responsibility to our retirees and all of that. So that's the focus, and keeping that in mind. And my concern is, today Iran, and what's the next company? North Korea? Is there going to be another company after that? And so we need to be extremely careful. Maybe this is a cause, and maybe has risen to such a level. I still have a serious caution. I think sanctions and some other things are great, and I like the language being improved of doing that, but I wanted to issue a serious caution to this only beginning, being only the beginning of many such actions, a dangerous place to go to.
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, I understand your concern, I guess I'm less worried about the slippery slope aspect of this, simply because, again, there are four states that are on the list of state sponsors of terrorism, and I guess in the Sudan case, we're talking about terrorism and genocide, which is a fairly small group of countries in the world that we're dealing with. We're not talking about minor policy issues. These are pretty core policy issues, and again, it's also perfectly in line with the foreign policy of the country.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'm totally on board with this, but I am a little sensitive to the slippery slope and the. And maybe the real question is, So does it take a statutory act to unwind this at the point that Iran would come off of said list, where the State Board of Investment can control that according to the terms in it?
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, I don't have the direct section to refer you to, but there is an exemption and an out, basically, if the Secretary of State says that this is not in the foreign policy interest of the nation, then this would not be effective. And all the United States Secretary of State. and if Iran comes off the list, then the bill is no longer effective.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. I guess we do need to have Ms. Baker.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Howard Bicker. I'm the Director of the State Investment Board. Madam Chair, what would you like me to do today? Address the amendment, address the bill? Where do we want to go?
The amendment is now part of the bill, so I guess the issue is to address the bill.
Okay. Well, if I could, I would like to address a couple of issues in the amendment, because I do think there are... If I could, Madam Chair...
It was an author's amendment, so we usually do put bills in the safety the author wants them without...
I understand that.
Discussion, so.
But I would like to suggest a couple of things as it relates to the amendment. The amendment, and again, I just saw this coming in, and Mr. Shepard did a very good job of trying to put it down, but we would like to suggest that where we talk about the board co-sponsoring shareholder resolutions, I think I've been consistent in telling various committees that, you know, we've done some background work on this, and we know how to do shareholder resolutions domestically. We are neophytes on the international side. So what I'd like to suggest, Madam Chair, is on the part of the amendment on page 4, line 14, which talks about the board initiating shareholder resolutions, on the third line where it says the board must sponsor, co-sponsor, I would like to suggest, Madam Chair, that there be a change to the effect that it would say the board, to the extent feasible, sponsor, co-sponsor. Because we really don't know exactly where we're going to be at this point in time. Madam Chair, I would also...
Well, why don't we deal with that, a separate issue? Representative Winkler?
Madam Chair, I guess subject to Mr. Shepard's review of the language, I certainly support the concept of...
Okay, so Representative Winkler moved... We might as well do them as they come on.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would move on line 1.12 of the amendment after the word board, insert the language to the extent feasible.
And
comments on both sides.
Well, that's a grammatical.
Okay.
Not rule, but choice. Sounds like comments, I guess.
I'll have to give you the book on the use of the comma.
It's
evolving. Thank you. Could you just repeat that based on the bill, because the amendment...
No, it's only amendment.
Okay, but did we not... We adopted the amendment to the bill.
Yes.
So could you just...
So if you want to refer back to the bill?
Yes.
Okay, so line
14.
Period. So, representative copy of the motion to the bill would be that,
Well, you have to do it. The amendment is part of the bill, but you have to see it to the amendment.
Okay. Yeah.
So the amendment, and if the language that needs to use is the amendment adopted, to the bill with the amendment adopted or something. We'll figure out what the right phrase is.
So, Madam Chair, I would support that.
Okay.
Move it.
All right. All those in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Okay.
And Madam Chair, if I could, one more, please. This is on line 4.12 of the bill, and I'm trying to work my way through all the amendments here, but it basically starts on line 11. It says such reports must be updated continually and submitted quarterly to, and then I don't know what updated continually means. Is that every minute or whatever? I would just like to suggest, Madam Chair and members, that if you would consider that we strike, that you all strike update continually and submitted quarterly, and just say submitted, and I would prefer annually. I mean, we're just going to be doing a report on the actions. There won't be a lot of changes on a quarterly basis, and just from an administrative standpoint. So I would like to respectfully submit that you would consider deleting update continually and submit annually.
What about leaving updated in and just taking continually out?
Update's fine. Okay. Just continually. And I would like to at least let you all think about doing it on an annual basis instead of on a quarterly basis.
Madam Chair, I guess the question for Mr. Baker would be whether the report would be just part of the annual report, which we talked about last time, or it would be a separate standalone.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, these are individual reports. Representative Kahn already sees the Sudan updates. So all the chairs of the various committees that the State Board of Investment reports to has jurisdiction over. These are individual reports.
Okay, so Madam Chair, I would move in the bill on line 4.12 that we strike the word continually and also strike the word quarterly and substitute annually.
Everyone understand that? Any questions? All those in favor of that amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, as to the bill, this bill has been heard in various committees. This bill has the effect, and these are numbers as of December 31st. These are moving targets as the markets move. So this would affect $280 million of equities under the management of State Board of Investment. Madam Chair and members, I really don't know what additional effect it would have with this addition, because now you've added debt securities. So there may be some additions to this, and I really do not know that as of right now. It has the effect of eliminating approximately 5.6% of our current international portfolio, slightly over 1% of our entire assets. It restricts around two-thirds of the international integrated oil companies that are currently available to us. There's been some discussion that this is very similar to the Sudan legislation that was enacted 2 years ago. It is very similar in a lot of the reporting requirements and some of the divestitures, but there are some significant differences. The Sudan legislation, to this date, we've divested $24 million. And this bill, if we went to the divestment route, would be at least 10 times as large. Also, in Section 7 of the bill, there is, and we've already discussed it, you all discussed this, and that is that the State Board of Investment has the option, if it believes it's reaching its fiduciary responsibility, not to divest. The Sudan legislation was very clear in the sense if companies did not comply with the criteria established in legislation, that divestiture would take place. So the bills, although many parts are very similar, there are some significant differences. And also, this bill now has debt instruments, whereas the Sudan legislation was equity. We have suggested, and Madam Chair and Representative Winkler have addressed this, as did the discussion at the Pension Commission last week, that a alternative approach or an additional approach would be to initiate shareholder resolutions. And that has since been added today in this amendment. So, Madam Chair and members, those are some of the factual issues. If there are any questions, I'd gladly respond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question. And I know you've testified about this before, and maybe just going back to some of what you've said before, but would there be a time where you would say it would make sense? I'm sensing that you're not all on board with this. And so I'm trying to get a some clarification to determine how on board you are or are not, and if you would in the future be looking at trying to be more amenable to this kind of situation.
Well, Madam Chair, the reality is my board has not taken an official position on this, so my position has been, therefore, as a staff, and that's just laying out the factual data. I always hate to be in these positions because I was in this position with the Sudan. It's like we're supporting Iran, and we're like far away from supporting Iran as you possibly can be. But I also have the other side of the equation, and that is we have a job to try to make as much money as we can for the Minnesota, the retirees, the employees, and so on and so forth. And when you reduce your investment set, you are reducing, theoretically, your opportunities to do that. That is one of the issues that I have had from a staff standpoint, is this piece of legislation is murkier in the sense that there are outs. In other words, you can decide whether you think it's fiduciarily responsible or not or whatever. In the Sudan legislation, the legislature says, we want you to do this. And effectively, by doing that, the legislature alleviated the State Board of Investment and staff from fiduciary responsibilities related to those facts. She said, we want to do this? Fine, we'll do it. This legislation kind of puts us in no man's land. And it's going to go down to some lawyers are going to be coming up with opinions, and people are going to make decisions, and that's kind of a different situation. If the legislature feels that they want to initiate a divestiture program, that is absolutely within their responsibility authority, and if that's passed, signed in the law, staff will absolutely do that, and we'll follow all that. But right now, we're kind of sitting there kind of halfway. And, it's a different situation than we've ever had in the past. So, I've been doing this for a very long time. I've seen a lot of different things that the legislature has done, and, that's fine. We will work as hard as we can to implement them. But it's just a new angle.
I hate to be too cynical, but somehow I think if we had come in with a bill that structured like the Sudan one, we would be hearing exactly the opposite argument, that we need the flexibility. But that's just my personal opinion. It's not.
Madam Chair, you're very much entitled to your own opinion. I can very honestly tell you, I personally would rather have straight direction, one way or another.
Any other comments?
No.
Representative Winkler renews his motion to have file 111 as amended be recommended to pass and go on to the Finance Committee. Any of us will get a chance to do this again.
No temptation.
I think the Humintasin will really be out of season by then. So I probably won't get this. Okay.
Well, I'm different versions of this.
No, make sure you take one on your way out. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
So you represented those.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm checking to see if I do have a testifier here.
Okay. No chair. Again, one of those strange military affairs is in our division, but it's not in our division, and it's in the Senate. It's so they end up in a separate conference committee, but we kind of deal with them, and the Junkies division deals with it too. So I'd like to pass it. So I'd like to move that House File 905 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Division. Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This one is much shorter and much simpler than the last bill you had to deal with.
Representative Cohen, do you want to make that motion?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll change the maker of the motion. Representative Cohen makes that motion.
This is a bill which very simply will grant the Department of Military Affairs the authority to accept some volunteer services and to end up paying those people mileage. And for specifics of that, the discussion of the Beyond the Yellow Ribbon program and why this is brought forward, I'll turn this over to my testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Don Kern. I'm the principal planner for the Department of Military Affairs. I'm here to testify on behalf of Colonel Almas, who's away at a ribbon-cutting ceremony for our Army Aviation Support Facility in St. Cloud today and couldn't be here. We started running into challenges with our Yellow Ribbon program. As you may or may not know, we rely heavily on volunteer support for that by using family members who have experience deployment and using them to help coach, teach, and mentor families who are undergoing the deployment experience. And as we found gifted speakers and people who were very helpful to the process of teaching other family members how to cope with the stresses of deployment, we found a need to ask them to move to other reintegration events around the state. And we ran into a problem not being able to compensate them for their expenses as they performed these valuable volunteer services, and this bill would fix that problem for us and allow us to compensate them for mileage incurred and those kinds of expenses, and also put them in the status should something bad happen to them, we'd be better able to do the right thing and take care of them in the event of an injury.
Okay, and if you notice in the fiscal note, members, there's the agency says they can absorb the very minimal expenses. Any questions of either the author or the witness? Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell me what the provisions of 16C.08 and 0.09 are and why that's necessary in your bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Holbrook, those are employment provisions which basically say that you can't replace state employees with volunteers under situations like this. It's an employment protection provision.
So let me just get this straight. Let me give you an example. If we're going to have a program at a city park on a weekend and the volunteers want to do the cleanups and the sweeping and stuff for the park facility, then they couldn't do that because there'd be some union employee that was supposed to do that?
Madam Chair, Representative Holbrook, no.
No what?
No, that would not be the case.
So the volunteers still would be able to clean up even though there was a union employee that could have done that job?
Madam Chair and Representative, this is dealing strictly with Department of Military Affairs and as they see fit to use this for their volunteers.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know why we have to have that in there. If we can get it done for free, why would we put this limitation on it, given our shortfall and everything?
No, because No, I think it's sort of best not to interfere with established purposes, particularly when we see that this would have no effect. But it's highly unlikely. We could look at what the details of those sections are, but it's really kind of firing somebody and rehiring someone else to do it. When you're looking at these kind of very temporary things, I don't see how it would relate to it.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Doty, does this only mean if an employee ends up fired as a result of the volunteer or loss of a $50 to the last of a few hours' work?
Madam Chair and Representative Fulberg, this simply means that existing statute, as we find it in 16C08 and 09, will be followed, that this will not preclude existing state law, so that there can be no interpretation that we're changing something that's already in existence. That's really the purpose of this reference, is to make sure that we do follow existing state law.
Right, thanks, Madam Chair.
Representative Holberg, if you'd like to change the existing state law, you should go to it and work on it from there. I mean, if you think that ought to be modified in the terms in which we're doing it, I think what Representative Doty is doing is taking this very simple, probably thing with probably universal acceptance, and just making sure that doesn't mess around with other state law. Now, if you think that other state law ought to be changed, that's a suggestion that you do that and not try and work on this bill to do
it. Well, Madam Chair, if I might, was this language in the bill when it was introduced?
Madam Chair and Representative, no, this was added in with complete agreement of Colonel Almas and the people who brought it forward from the state employees, simply to make sure that state law would be followed.
And Madam Chair, so basically what we had is we had the Ag Committee adopting amendments for an issue that's under the jurisdiction of the State Government Committee on it, assuming I don't think it was introduced this way, and if you need another bill, I can understand that, but I think that we should provide great latitude for residents of the state of Minnesota that want to volunteer on behalf of military programs in the state.
Any other questions or discussion? Okay, I'll renew the motion that has what? Oh, Representative Cohn. Okay, Representative Cohn renews the motion that has file 905 recommended to pass and go to the Finance Committee. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion passed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 8 is the False Claims Act. And Madam Chair, before I get too deeply into my testimony, since this is the Finance Committee, I assume you want me to focus mostly on finances.
Yes.
But for the benefit of those who haven't yet heard this bill, and I think most on this committee through its long, long path have heard it, but a few have not yet. So for the benefit of them, I'd like to say just a little bit about the policy, if I may, Madam Chair. Okay. The False Claims Act, as I said, is House File 8. It's got the maximum 35 authors in the House. It has bipartisan support. And basically, I think we can all agree that defrauding the taxpayers is always wrong, but it's even worse at a time like this. And this year, with this bill, we have an opportunity to do something about that and at the same time get a very generous financial bonus from the federal government just for passing this law. So passing this law as it is and doing nothing else, even if it sits on the shelf forever and is never used, will get us a bonus from the federal government. And I'll explain why that's the case. I've had many meetings with stakeholders, over a dozen by my count right now, have adopted many, many of their proposed changes, 11 out of the 13 proposed by one coalition of groups, including giving up one of the key jewels in the crown on this bill, which is retroactivity, so it's no longer retroactive. It only starts as of August 1st, 2009. The Department of Human Services and the Governor's Office are neutral on this bill, as are other state departments. This originally started out as Lincoln's Law enacted during the Civil War as a way for the federal government to go after crooked contractors who, for example, sold bad mules and bad food to the Union Army knowingly. And since then, it's evolved and morphed into something a little bit different, which is basically a way by which whistleblowers in the private sector can report those who knowingly defraud the taxpayers, as by overbilling or underpaying. And again, the key word here is knowingly. I have to emphasize that, as many have heard me and other committees emphasize over and over again. This is not a bill that gets at conduct that is done unintentionally, accidentally, and so forth. It's only knowing conduct. And the word knowingly is very well defined in a way that's recognizable in courts in all 50 states. So it's only those who knowingly defraud the government. And then those people, those whistleblowers, can bring suit, stand in the shoes of the government, and, of course, recoup a portion of what's recovered on behalf of the taxpayers. And then the state actually gets up to, depending on the circumstances, three times actual damages. Now, the federal law has been on the books a long time and applies to contractors who cheat the federal government knowingly, but only the feds can help the feds, and only the states can help the states. So 22 states have then moved on and enacted their own versions of the False Claims Act to confront contractors, again, who knowingly take money from the taxpayers. Various state laws have been very successful in rooting out fraud. In your packets are examples of some recent settlements that are eye-poppers, and although we can't promise settlements or judgments of that kind in Minnesota, you can see by what's in your packet that many other states have had success in reclaiming and recovering money that is rightfully theirs and their taxpayers using this law. So, seeing these great results, what the federal government did just 3 years ago was a real watershed. And I should add that this is a bipartisan proposal up and down the country. The chief patron in the U.S. Senate is not a Democrat. It's Republican Senator Charles Grassley. Governor George W. Bush of Texas signed this into law when he was governor. Ronald Reagan signed the enactments that modernized the act in 1986, and so on and so on. But what Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa did was he tucked in a provision into the Balanced Budget Act of 2006 saying that if states pass a False Claims Act with four criteria, all of which this bill presently meets, that the state will automatically get a 10% bonus on the monies it recovers from Medicaid fraud. And let me give you an example. As you know, MA, as we call it in this state, is a 50-50 proposition. The feds pay 50% and we pay 50%. So if in Minnesota a case were to recover $10 million in Medicaid fraud, under current law right now as we're sitting here, that would be a $5 million, $5 million split. $5 million maintained here in the state and $5 million would go to the federal government. If we pass this law, even if we do nothing else and it sits on the shelf, and even if, by the way, Medicaid fraud were recovered through some other statute, not this statute, common law fraud, any other means, that would go to a 60-40 split. We would get to keep $6 million instead of $5 million. The feds would get $4 million instead of $5 million. So automatically we get that bonus, but if we stay true to these four criteria. So, and you can see in your packet some of the examples of the benefits that states have reaped from that. So, the Minnesota False Claims Act, House File 8, would do the same thing, provide financial incentives to whistleblowers whose employers knowingly, again the word knowingly, defraud the state government. And so, like the federal law, Minnesota's False Claims Act would allow whistleblowers to bring claims on behalf of the government. The Attorney General's office would then have the option to intervene. Now, that's key to this hearing, Madam Chair. We made the conscious decision at the very beginning of this process to put, as half the states do, the word may in there and not the word shall. We didn't think it was very fair to impose a mandate upon a state agency and tell them they have to get involved in cases that they don't need to get involved in. So we said may, like about half the states do, instead of shall. Some go even further. Some states say shall diligently. I don't know what that really gets them, but they mean we really, really mean it, or something like that. So it's, so about three or four states say shall diligently. Many say shall. We say may. So the Attorney General's office may have 60 days to review a case filed by a whistleblower and decide whether it, the Attorney General's office, wants to, it need not, but wants to intervene in the case. And if so, then it takes over the case, and then the whistleblower would get a smaller share, after all, at that point, because the Attorney General's office is running the show and running the case, not the whistleblower and his or her attorney. So, again, this applies only to knowing fraud. It doesn't apply to innocent contractors or nuisance lawsuits by greedy insiders. Remember, we already have a Federal False Claims Act in place. Already have this exact same language in terms of the culpability standard, the exact same language. We already have this exact same standard of conduct and behavior in place. No institution, be it a hospital, be it a healthcare provider, be it anyone in our economy, a construction contractor, is going to have to change their practices to comply with this new expectation of their behavior. This behavior is already hanging over them as an umbrella under the federal act. So anyone right now who wanted to launch a divisive and hateful and spiteful nuisance lawsuit against an employer already has the means, ample means, to do that right now. And my suspicion is they haven't under the False Claims Act. So no contractor will be liable for accidental or inadvertent wrongdoing. And the other key thing is, like the federal law and all the state laws that I'm aware of, and we've discussed this in other committees, but Madam Chair, it bears some repeating here, it only applies to whistleblowers who are the, quote, original source. And that's an important point. This isn't someone who heard gossip or water cooler talk in the cafeteria and decided they'd run to court. The person who brings the claim must have actual knowledge. They must be the independent source, the independent source, the original and independent source, I should say, original and independent source of the information. A true insider, someone who really knows that this is going on. Now, not at this hearing, but at all the other hearings, the three previous hearings, we've had testimony, and many of you have had the opportunity to hear that, from Neil Thompson, a pharmacist from right here in the Twin Cities, from Minneapolis, born and bred, who used to be a pharmacy owner and a private pharmacist and broke onto the national stage last year, and you might have seen him on CNN or the Star Tribune or the New York Times, when he blew the whistle and successfully led, because of his efforts and one of his colleagues at a large pharmacy company, resulted in the recovery for the government of $9 million in fraud. Again, knowing those who knowingly duped the system. And so he gave very compelling testimony that I won't try to duplicate here about why the need for whistleblowers. And you know, the example we gave in other committees, and then I'll get to the finance part, Madam Chair, but you know, why whistleblowers? Why is that important? Won't the fraud, if it exists at all, be made readily apparent and aware to all of us? And the answer is no. And what he points out in his own case is that this is very often a career-ending proposition, a career-ending proposition. He gave examples from his own life, but also from others, that it's a very serious thing to do the kind of thing that he did. The other anecdotal kind of example that I have been giving in some of the other hearings that many of you heard is the Petters situation that we've all seen. You know, it's apples to oranges in the sense that the Petters swindle, from what we know of it, is not a swindle that is implicated or victimized the government, as far as we know yet. That hasn't been uncovered. But I think the underlying principle is an important one, which is, if you remember just reading the newspaper accounts, as I have and all of you have, this woman, Deanna Coleman, 42 years old, walked off the street one day, and in a pang of conscience, nothing more, went into the FBI office in Minneapolis and spilled the beans about what she saw and what she had helped oversee over the previous decade or so. And the federal government admitted in the newspaper, on the record, naming names, that they had no clue this was going on. They didn't have a wiretap, they didn't have an informant, they didn't have a hint, they didn't have a tip. And this may very well have gone undetected indefinitely had it not been for her bravery. She's going to pay the price for it, as she should. She's going to go to prison for a long time. But it was still brave of her to uncover what they had done. And that principle, I think, is alive and well in the False Claims Act and why so many states have adopted it, Republican and Democratic governors alike. Section 12, I should point out, of the bill allows for attorney's fees for the defendant if the individual loses the lawsuit. It allows for a full attorney's fees, so that's something that certainly won't encourage frivolous lawsuits. It's a real slap at those who might try to launch them. Again, we got rid of retroactivity. And I just want to preface something that you've heard in at least some of the committees, maybe most, that we've heard this bill in, that we've already got laws on the books that deal with it. We've already got common law fraud. We've got other statutes. And sure, there are other tools. But here's the gap that the False Claims Act fills. First of all those other laws and tools that we have, they either are only confined to Medicaid fraud and not any other kind of fraud, or they don't allow a whistleblower to actually bring a lawsuit, it would have to be law enforcement. And most importantly, none of those get us the 10% bump worth potentially many millions of dollars in the next few years alone. None of those get us the bump that passing this law will get us. And in a time like this, when our constituents have told us that they want us to think outside the box and do something different, I think this is an idea whose time has come. You know, I went on the road, as many of you did, and heard a lot of these town hall meetings. I went to Albert Lea, I went to Winona, I went to Woodbury, and I went to Plymouth. And the two big messages, not surprisingly, this is rational behavior, were please don't raise our taxes and please don't cut our spending. And that's totally rational, absolutely. But this is a way to get back what is rightfully ours and our constituents without doing either of those things. It's not a tax increase, and it's not a spending cut. I'll get to the money part.
Okay, once you move your bill to finance.
Oh, yes. Okay. I should have moved my bill. Madam Chair, I move the House File 8 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. As to the cost, Madam Chair, and I know that's why we're really here, and I hope we're not going to revisit too much of the policy here today, but as to the cost, the preliminary fiscal note, at least, indicates by the Attorney General and the Attorney General only that there is a cost to the Attorney General's office. And I want to treat this very seriously, members, because this is the first time this has come up. Naturally, this is its first finance. And I have a lot to say about this. I'll try to make it quick. It should surprise no one that I'm very disappointed that there is a fiscal cost. And I'm going to look you all in the eye and tell you right now there is no fiscal cost for the Attorney General's office for this bill. I know about very few things in this life. Very few things. One of them is how the Attorney General's office runs, because I was there for almost 5 years. So you got to trust me on this one. There are other reasons, and I would let you draw your own conclusions about what those may be. Others have speculated publicly and otherwise about what they might be. You can draw your own conclusions. But here's why. I'm going to tick off the reasons why there is no net cost to the Attorney General's office. No net cost. Number one, and most importantly, our bill says, as I already mentioned, that the Attorney General's office may, not shall, may get involved in the False Claims Act business, essentially. It need not ever touch that area of the law if we pass this. The whole idea behind the False Claims Act is to empower the private bar and private litigants to go ahead and stand in the government's shoes. In actuality, at the federal level, a tiny percentage of cases include government intervention. Most of them, the federal government and the Department of Justice says, no, we're going to pass on this. Maybe not because the merits are bad, because they don't have the resources or the interest, or they think the private bar would be more effective in pursuing those cases. So, you know, if we attached a fiscal note to every bill that authorized an agency, authorized a commission, authorized a county or a city to do something, there's no way we'd pass anything around here. That is simply not a reason to book a cost. You know, I did a little homework last night, and this comes under the category of has no life. But I, last night, I, in advance of this hearing, I went online, and late last night, actually, and took a look at other constitutional office provisions and places where we as the legislature have decided that they may do something for which I'm positive we have never booked a cost. Did you know, for example, that under, for the state auditor, for example, did you know that the state auditor under section, let's see here, under section, I can't find it here. Oh, here, no, Secretary of State's office, section 5.02. Did you know that we have authorized the Secretary of State to hire a stenographer? Now, Representative Kiffmeyer, did you ever hire a stenographer in the Secretary of State's office?
Madam Chair and Representative Simon, no.
Okay.
I could even do so.
Well, you may hire a stenographer, and I bet you in none of the years that where you honorably served as Secretary of State, did you ever submit a fiscal note for a 1.0 FTE for stenographer? Because after all, we authorized you to hire a stenographer, so that means you have to do it, of course. Our statute says that that you may and not shall. And to me, that's case closed. And I understand the argument, political or otherwise, that I understand the Attorney General's office has made to others. Certainly not to me. They've never called me about this bill, despite having championed it since 2004, and then again in 2005, 2006, 2007, and 2008. This year, lights out, no contact. They've never contacted me on this bill. But others, I understand, they've said, look, we're going to want to. We're going to want to if you authorize us and say that we may. That shouldn't be good enough. if we attached a fiscal note every time an agency said, we're going to want to avail ourselves of something you say we might do, you know, we'd never get anything done, or we would, and we'd just bankrupt the state. So that ought not to cut it in a committee like this. And I'm looking you all straight in the eye based on one of the very few things I know in life, and that's the function of the AG's office. I'm telling you that is an absolutely intellectually bankrupt rationale for a fiscal note. Secondly,
okay, also, I don't want to interrupt you, but I do believe there is someone here from the attorney general.
I'm enthusiastically awaiting that testimony.
Okay.
Secondly, the bill has never had a fiscal note from the Department of Finance since its inception in 2004, even though it passed the full Senate once during that time. It went through three committees and then passed the full Senate, and the Attorney General's office was asked in 2004 and 2005, will there be? Do we need a fiscal note? And they said affirmatively, no, we won't, there won't be. And we have the documentation to show that. Third, other states with may language instead of shall language have agreed that there was no fiscal cost. And you have in your packets the letter that I sent to Commissioner Tom Hansen back in the last week of February, where I detail the other states, some of them may states, some of them shall states, and in no may states that we were able to find through the False Claims Act was there ever any fiscal note. The shall states sure did have some because we said they shall intervene, or not shall intervene, but shall review all of these cases, and I think that's telling. Next, I'll let you know that there's one loophole in here that the Attorney General's office always has, and it's in statute under Chapter 8, and it's been used in recent years. If the Attorney General's office feels that it has a case that it wants to pursue on behalf of the public, but that it doesn't have the resources to pursue, it can always, under state statute and with our approval, with legislative approval, it can farm that case out to the private bar. And we have a very recent example of that in the last 3, 4, 5 years. Attorney General Mike Hatch decided that he wanted to, on behalf of the state of Minnesota, intervene or sue on behalf of taxpayers against in a securities case against AOL Time Warner. But instead of doing it in-house, he got our permission at the legislature, because any time the expense might exceed $1 million, I think it is, has to go through us, and got our permission to farm it out to the law firm of Hines, Mills, and Olson in Minneapolis, and it was successful. Hines, Mills, and Olson got a fantastic result for the state, but that wasn't done in-house. So that's something that is always available to the Attorney General's office. So, members, you know, I understand that there's a fiscal note in front of you, and believe me, I've talked with nonpartisan staff here, and I want to be absolutely intellectually honest with you, because we know it's very easy to come up with tricks and gimmicks to get around fiscal notes. I'm here to tell you, this is not a trick, this is not a gimmick. Look at the word may versus the word shall, and ask yourself whether there's really a reason why we're going from zero fiscal note for years and years and years to over $2 million. A fiscal note for a bill that only tells them they may do something instead of shall. That's my case to you. Thanks, members.
You will hear from the Attorney General's office, but Representative Bingham.
Is there more states that have than shall, or what's the breakdown?
Unless
you're
talking
to some policy
in
that, which I
can. You know, it is relevant. It is really relevant to the fiscal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bingham, I think it's about half and half. The scale may tip slightly in favor of the shall states, I think. I think that's right, but it's close to half are the may states.
Okay. Well, let's go down.
Madam Chair, would you indulge a question on the policy and the content of it as compared to the system? I'm one of the few that hasn't. You know.
Sure. You may not answer it. But
thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Simon, you emphasized a lot, knowingly and knowing as provisions, and yet in line 1.20, it says no proof of specific intent to defraud is required. And as a non-attorney, if you could reconcile those for me from a legal standpoint, and I'll tell you the direction my questioning is coming, having worked with some very large, how complicated the back office claims processing systems and business processes are, not having to prove intent could open up, in my mind, a plethora of problems. So that'd be the angle I'd be coming from.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Downey. That's a great question. We still have to prove intent, and the level of intent is the knowing or knowingly standard. But the concept of specific intent is something different than just intent. You do have to show intent. The way I was taught, at least in law school, is if I shoot into a crowd and I kill Mary, but not you, I'm sorry. I kill Melanie. Right. I'm sorry, Representative Kepler. And I shoot Jane Doe, let's say, and I kill her. That is knowing disregard. That would be knowingly, you know, causing her death. It wouldn't be intentionally causing her death in terms of specific intent. Specific intent is if I zeroed in on her in a crowd and I, with the intent of doing that specific damage and having that specific outcome, that would be the specific intent to end the life of Jane Doe. That's the way I was taught it in law school. But the knowingly standard is, of course, a form of intent. It's not specific intent.
So getting down to particulars, I mean, the reimbursement codes and the combinations of diagnoses and procedures that drive the fee schedules and all of these things are incredibly complex under the covers, and I'm guessing that that's probably where the real money is in these lawsuits, is somebody who has intentionally structured their claims systems and claims operations to optimize revenues from a business standpoint. And so, anyway, it seems really fuzzy to me where intent would figure into that. I'm not super comfortable on the policy side here, and I know we're only talking about the financial side. But boy, I'm not sure how you wouldn't open up some really large organizations to a lot of opportunistic whistleblowing for the sake of attorney's fees and things. Put it right out on the table. There's a lot of complexity under there that people could exploit.
Well, I mean, that's a fair concern to raise, Representative Downey. It really is, and I don't want to be dismissive of that. I guess the only thing I would say is that right now these folks are already living under the same regime with the Federal False Claims Act, which also has a knowingly standard. So I guess the argument would be, and your argument perhaps, I don't want to put words in your mouth as well, that may be true, but this moves the needle a little bit closer to someone acting as opposed to non-acting. I suppose that's true, but I think highly unlikely, since the money is likely to be far bigger in a Federal False Claims Act case, particularly if there are other similar actors. So I think you raise a point which is a fair point to raise. I just think when balancing everything and considering that there's a Federal False Claims Act in place now under which all of us live, all of our businesses, that worries me less. But you raise a fair consideration, at least.
Just one final comment. One person's intent to defraud may be another business person's legitimate attempt to optimize revenue given the complexity of the code structures and things. So anyway, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
That's why we have all these attorneys. Representative Holder asked
this.
Who in favor of the
government?
Representative Holder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On a fiscal note, on page 5 under local government costs, it talks about an assumption that there'll be amendments to the bill to clarify that investigation and prosecution claims by municipalities will be prosecuted by the attorney for the local unit of government. Are you here your intent to do that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, there's a debate about whether we need to do that at this point at all, or whether that would be redundant. If it gives people more comfort, I suppose we could do. I'm not convinced that we do have to do that. And in talking with staff, I don't know that we do. In other words, I think what you're getting at, Representative Holberg, is if the county wants to initiate one of these or intervene in a whistleblower suit, it would be the county attorney's office and not the attorney general's office that would go after it.
Representative Simon, I'm just reading this paragraph on local government costs, and I'm also not understanding, given we have a preliminary fiscal note with silence from the admin department, is this still getting laid over so we have final fiscal notes, or
well,
what are we doing from a committee process here?
why isn't that? You know, if anyone in this committee really understands our committee process, but my intention is to pass the bill on because I think it has to go several other places.
Yes.
It has to go several other places. Oh, administration showed no coin. That's why there's nothing.
I just to clarify, since someone has already pointed this out, there are pages that appear to be missing from the fiscal note. I did this on purpose. I should have made a note of it. Those are the pages related to human services and transportation because they had not completed the fiscal note. There wasn't any information in the system, and admin said there was no impact to their agency, and that would take another two pages to show no impact. So I just put those out. Since those would have all been blank pages. The pages that are in front of you are the only pieces of information that were actually in the fiscal note system, other than admin statements that there was not an impact.
Well, and I'm sure, and I mean, I appreciate the clarification of that. I think that, you know, the fact that admin is under this committee's jurisdiction, I mean, I kind of like to see what their assumptions were and how they came up with it. I think that's helpful. But, and I don't know how your committee structure all works. I don't even waste time trying to figure it out. But I did receive a copy of a letter from the Speaker of the House that talked about committee process in this body. And that's what I continue to be concerned with. And while certainly I know that we're up against deadline and things have to move, I would much prefer that we have a final fiscal note on the issues that are under this committee's jurisdiction so we know what we're dealing with before we just move things on. From a process point of view, again, not trying to figure out your committee structure.
Okay. Well, let me start by bringing up the Attorney General, and then I'll give you my analysis on it, and you can either vote for it or against it. But I think the, I think I philosophically agree with you, but trying to deal with how we set things up and how things move through them. I would say that the final decision on the fiscal impact of this bill will be contained in our division bill. And it will be either, and the bill will either pass without an appropriation with it or with an appropriation, but we'll, and the bill may end up in, or the fiscal part of the bill may end up in our bill, or it may not be. But the fiscal decision will be made in this division. It's just because of our structure, it's really hard to make it today and then to let the bill continue on its way. So we'll see that part of the bill yet. But let's have the person from the Attorney General's office. Anyone wants to make some comments? Yes.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Deborah Peterson. I'm an assistant attorney general in the Attorney General's office. I manage the Medicaid fraud division.
Okay.
I'm here to answer your question.
Okay. Are there any questions for Ms. Peterson?
Okay.
Representative Holder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And were you the one that actually prepared the fiscal note?
Madam Chair, Representative, I worked on the fiscal note with members of our administration department, and I had conversations with the Attorney General regarding the fiscal note.
And if I might, I hope maybe you heard the discussion around the page 5 paragraph on local government costs. Did the AG's office have any recommendation about further clarification that needed to be made, and or further cost if there are no further amendments to this bill?
Madam Chair, Representative, our office is working with Senator Lance and Senate Counsel on the bill itself and on clarifying the language. We do believe at this time that there does need to be clarification in the language as to who would take the lead role or who would be doing the review of a claim that was against a municipality, or say for instance the school district or a local unit of government. Right now, the way the current law is written, it does say that the Attorney General's office may review, but it also gives us a time period in which time we have to make a decision whether we're going to intervene. It does have a lot of, and the language may versus shall to us is doesn't really say anything other than it's our responsibility. Because if you look at the controlling federal law for the Deficit Reduction Act, it requires that your False Claims Act is consistent with the federal law, and that also that the Attorney General's Office will be involved and they will do the review.
Representative Kipler. If Representative Holbrook, are you finished with your questions? I didn't want to interrupt your...
Well, it maybe I'm getting more confused. It seems that this is issue kind of outstanding. So, from my perspective, the author is an honorable author and has never steered me wrong as far as his intent. Or can you let the committee know, is it your intent that this bill would have a zero fiscal note for local unit of government type cases? And if that's the case, is there a local government cost that we need to be concerned with? And to what degree was this discussed in the state and local government operations, reform, technology, and elections committee?
Mouthful. Representative Holbrook. Madam Chair, Representative Holbrook. Yes, it is my intention that there be zero fiscal note. If an amendment surfaces and someone feels that there needs to be language, I'm happy to put it in to clarify in terms of the various lines of authority. That doesn't directly answer your question. In terms of local fiscal impact, yes. Because of the May language, no local unit of government, county, city, needs to get involved in this at all. The very idea of having a whistleblower is that they can stand in the government's shoes. They can review it if they want. They can seek to intervene if they want, but they need not. They can say, we want to wash our hands of this and we don't ever want to be involved in the False Claims Act business.
Okay, then just to clarify, so what I'm hearing from the AG's office is we're trying to get a zero fiscal note because we don't want to get into the local unit of government issues, but there may be costs on the local government level. What I'm hearing from you is that you're looking for a bill in which there's no fiscal note for either the AG or the local unit of government.
Let me clarify that. There's no net fiscal. Okay. Maybe one may argue that there is a need for an appropriation to the Attorney General's office, but we will have to argue the net fiscal effect.
Okay, so, and I mean, that makes me feel a little better if that's
yes.
what you're working
yeah.
towards, that we're not going to have any
zero fiscal
impact.
Correct.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Any other Representative
Chipman? Yes, again, since the Attorney General's office is here, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, one of the things I'm realizing is that the Attorney General is going to take on a bit of work, but I also read in here that there's some compensation being paid out to the whistleblower or to the person who brings the issue forward, and so it looks like there's money being involved there where Attorney General has some costs and then some money is being paid out, and how is that represented in a fiscal note?
Representative. Did you want me to answer?
Yes.
Madam Chair, Representative Kipmeyer, in a False Claims Act where there's a relator and the relator has an attorney and there is an attorney general or there is the Attorney General of the United States involved, what happens when there's a settlement and there's a recovery, the relator's share comes out of the federal government share if you're not a False Claims Act state. If you're a False Claims Act state, comes out of the state share for the relator. Those attorney's fees for the relator's attorney, they come out of a different pool of money. And there is provisions in some False Claims Act for the Attorney General's office in some cases to recover their costs. But what I would say to you is all of those costs come out of the same pot of money. You know, if your settlement is $5 million, you're still dividing $5 million. You're just dividing it in different ways among different people.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Kipmeyer, I don't know if this is what you're getting to, and stop me if it isn't, but if what you're suggesting is that maybe some of those monies could go to the Attorney General's office to defray costs, is that where you were going with this or not necessarily?
Madam Chair, I'm looking for your answer to that, for an explanation of how all those things interrelate on those fiscal costs and that fiscal note. So I appreciate your explanation.
Okay.
Or, I'm going, you didn't explain it. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, Representative Kiffmeyer, there are a number of states, not very many, that have either attempted or enacted some sort of special litigation fund where some portion of the recoveries for the state actually go to their Attorney General's office in the case that the Attorney General's office has intervened. I know Kansas, which does not have a False Claims Act, but is considering one now. There was an amendment in their Senate, I believe, recently that created such a mechanism. Because I can understand for any state agency, it's got to be a frustrating thing. You bring in money for the state, and you don't get to keep it. It goes to the general fund. I think you know something about that, Representative Kiffmeyer. And so in some states, they sweeten the pot by saying, look, some of this will go directly, not just to the general fund, but to the Attorney General's office. I mean, there's nothing stopping us from doing that. It hasn't been an idea that's been proposed so far. But because there's no net fiscal impact, I don't see a need for that. But if it were the committee's wish or someone else, that's something we could talk about. It is complicated, and I don't know if that's the road we want to go down. But that's something that has been tried elsewhere.
Madam Chair, just a follow-up question. So if I understand you correctly, Representative Simon, then the expenses from the Attorney General would come out of that recovery.
Not the way the bill was written.
Correct. I'm saying that's something we could do, and a small number of states have thought about doing, or I think maybe a couple actually have. We could do it that way, but this bill does not.
Spent the first half of my legislative career trying to get rid of dedicated funds every place I saw them, and now it looks like I'll spend the second half of my
putting them
back. Hopefully not putting them back. Maybe hopefully doing new ones.
Madam Chair, you're past the halfway point.
No, I've already started. The argument to that not needing the dedicated funds is that if you do honest legislative appropriation and you look at where you spend money and where it comes and when it comes back in, you could do all this without having a dedicated fund. Unfortunately, we've seen that hasn't been happening.
Madam Chair, I have definitely experienced that happening, and I'm glad you've seen the light.
Well, I don't really say that, but I just do have this twinge of conscience whenever I do something like support the amendment which passed and that sort of thing. Okay, I guess Representative Simon renews his motion. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passed. Minutes? Okay, Representative, I move the minutes of March 17th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes passed, and the meeting is adjourned.